Hello and welcome to the Scottish Housing News podcast with me, Kieran Finlay, the editor of Scottish Housing News, and campaigner and former Dundee housing convener, Jimmy Black. While there's always much to talk about regarding housing in Scotland, for this, our last episode of the year, we thought we'd bring you a slightly different perspective. In recent episodes, we've talked about standards of temporary accommodation, the importance of good urban design, and the challenges of using eco-friendly materials and building properties in rural areas. But how about doing all this in the wake of a natural disaster, or in the aftermath of a war zone?
Working with Year 5 architecture students at the University of Dundee, architect and lecturer Lawrence Wood has been doing just that. Earlier this year, he took a group to Turkey, which had just suffered from a terrible earthquake, to live in rural camps and experience the challenges of displaced people. There he has been putting into practice his research on the challenges of post-disaster reconstruction, and, just maybe, there are things we can take on board back here, home in the UK. So, Lawrence, what's in your background that put you in this position? What got you interested?
Firstly, thanks for inviting me along today. Where did I start? High school. Barely got through high school. Didn't really know what I wanted to do. Diagnosed with dyslexia very early on. Found it quite hard to communicate ideas. And like growing up in Grangemouth, the most likely job you had was going into trade. So I ended up on a building site in KGXX in the Grangemouth refinery, working with engineers and getting my hands dirty with concrete. Quite realised that that's maybe not the job for me, but I did work. I did work very, very hard. Had a couple of really good engineers that helped me and said, you know, have you thought about doing something along the lines of engineering or architecture? I hadn't really thought about it. Applied through Clearin, had a great architect and mentor, Brian Adams at University of Dundee, and he said, you're in, first year architecture. And from there on, I learned how to communicate in a different way, kind of increased my awareness that I didn't need to communicate through just writing. It was through video, drawing skills and things like that. Had a great time at university, made a lot of great friends, but just after that, you come off this year five thesis and you're launched into the real world. And I worked on a few different practices, getting, you know, my bearings and everything. I'd done my year out in Toronto as a kid from Grangemouth. I didn't think I'd get further than Falkirk bus station, but I did that, and it increased my confidence. So going out into practice, I kind of knew what I wanted to start doing, and that was going back to the building site, weirdly enough, get my hands dirty, finding out. Didn't know half of the things that were written on the sections that I was looking at university, and I had to realise, like, is that a bit of steel? What size is that? How do you move it? So the first practice I worked with was Fergus Purley Architects. Fergus was he was a tutor at the university at the time, and I had done some work with him. But he was quite pragmatic in terms of getting on site. And so I asked him if I could get on site and build something. So, lucky me, the first building that I designed with him, or helped to make the modelling and things like that, he asked me if I wanted to build it. So I took a year doing that. But throughout that time,
what was the building?
It was a house in Collinsborough in Fife. Great family, great clients.
Private residence.
Yeah. A steading that we basically the carcass was still there, and we built the frame on the inside. So as a young student, or now a graduated student, going in with a tool belt on, ordering materials, taking the gyp for all the guys on the site, working in the cold, working in the heat, living in a caravan. It was great. It was another adventure. I'd gone on an adventure during university in Toronto, and then this was just another chapter, and I got the bug, wanted to build. But during fourth and fifth year, I'd kind of looked at kind of building for vulnerable people. I had had phone calls from clients that maybe made me question who my client was and how my career was going to develop, not being a careerist. But I kind of just, I wanted to establish who I wanted to work for and what really interested me. So I knew that building was interesting me. But growing up in Grangemouth, miners in my family, we kind of knocked on doors and asked for soup when I was younger, and as donations. And that kind of stuck with me, and I was like, do you know what, these things are happening around the world. Katrina had just hit New Orleans. I went, sold a bunch of stuff and got a trip over there and started volunteering for what was 3 months. It turned into about a year and a half living in a tent and building houses in an American way. So I had to get used to foot and inches very, very quickly. And that changed everything. That 3 months of listening to, you know, listening to some experiences that guys had been through. The storm that hit New Orleans was on the TV, but I had moved to Mississippi, Gulf Coast, Mississippi, Biloxi, had been hit really hard. It was the most vulnerable area in America at the time. So it was the most vulnerable area of the lowest income state in America. And just the people were incredible. So the resilience of the people, but also the kind of, there was still a kind of, maybe not even a deep South mentality, but a survivor mentality of, isn't it funny how we, you know, got through that, and I saved my neighbour next door, and we gave everyone food, and we had fried chicken on, and the day after it, and it was just this kind of masking of quite a deep trauma that they'd been through.
What were you building?
So I was building homes there in New Orleans. The houses had been flooded. The storm had brought, in some cases, 14 feet high waves into people's homes. Now, for a construction podcast, the houses in Mississippi are as basic as you can get. It's a timber kit built on top of 7-Newton block. So when a storm comes in, we've seen cases where buildings have actually physically landed on cars. They've been uplifted so much, they've landed on a car. It's about 175 mile an hour gusts. Sustained over quite a long period of time. It was a Category 5 hurricane. No hurricane straps in these areas. The houses were built, modified by the people, locals, neighbours. So the building code wasn't really an issue, so it affected a huge number of people. So the homes had to be gutted because of the swell waters. That hadn't happened for about 6 months, so you can imagine going into those buildings and tearing down gyprock, in some cases insulation, smashed toilet, smashed glass, wearing suits and masks in 36 degree heat during the summer. So that didn't put me off at all. I'd say it encouraged what I would term now as a collective. We had other university students, we had other school leavers in America, all come and help. Locals helped, and that networking just changed everything. What my outlook was, and
so this was your first experience.
That was the first one.
Displaced people. And
yep.
Building. Were you building temporary homes or permanent homes?
These were permanent homes. So during that time, it was the Bush administration. Basically, temporary accommodation was provided in the form of caravans or Winnebagos in America. So on the land, the family would be displaced, you know, 15 feet into a Winnebago, given time to do up their home. That, it wasn't the best scenario. It took a long time. It was all unskilled labour. We didn't, the group, I can probably name them, all hands at the time. It was hands-on Gulf Coast. A guy called David Campbell, who had originally started in tech companies and gone into delivering aid after the Indonesian tsunami. And this was the second iteration of his response. And it got young people just involved in a way that we thought we knew what we were doing. We had experts come in for 2 weeks, advise, go away. We had Green Oak carpenters come in, advise, go away. We had contractors come in the same way. We had Amish builders from Iowa, which was great. They came down, all their old tools, and the respect that they had on site was immense. So you can imagine, as a formative years of a young architectural career, kind of pinching yourself and going, I'm building homes. I'm designing on the back of packets. I'm talking with experts. I'm kind of again on another adventure, and it's not going through the RIB codes of practice. It's responsive. It's very pragmatic, and you're making decisions based on what you're hearing. And that doesn't happen in practice, or what that didn't happen. What was in practice, it was a meeting with your client, and you try and deliver the best response to their needs. But this was slightly different. This was constantly asking questions and being supportive in a completely different way.
Right, come back to some of that at the end. But you were moving on towards working with the UN.
I mean, yeah.
What other things did you do between Mississippi and when you eventually got to the Philippines?
A little bit of everything. As I said, I'm not a careerist, but this gave me the kind of spark to get back home, get a bit of money, build more. I was working with Urban Outfitters. I moved to Sweden to do some work with Urban Outfitters and build furniture for stores and things like that, do some design.
So it's all just to pay for the next adventure.
Pay for the next one to see what I could do. But in the meantime, I had been reading and giving myself a kind of my own research in a way. It's actually weird saying that.
Yeah, you say you're not a careerist, but you had some idea in mind of a thesis or some research or some sort of end goal that you wanted to reach.
Yeah, but my thought pattern was, I'm not the guy that researches stuff. But there was a passion, definitely. I think that's what I would kind of term it. I couldn't wait to get back out. I was keeping track of storms. I was keeping track of what was developing as a kind of new humanitarian sector, and I wanted to be part of it. But just through keeping up connections, I was working in Stockholm, and Typhoon Yolanda hit in the Philippines, and I got a call to say, "Would you like to respond to this? We've got a position open." This was about 5 months after Yolanda, so the period of time after the emergency, the World Health Organization had just left. I probably don't need to go into what they were doing in a post-disaster scenario.
What year was this?
That was 2014, so there's quite a gap between coming back in 2008 and 2014. But what I say to my students is that's what it takes to kind of, as I say, it might be a little bit easier now to get into the sector, but I trapped a lot of doors and I did a lot of labouring jobs just to get through, and I was quite... Do you know, sometimes you learn a lot from working in a warehouse. and I loved that. It was physical work, and I knew I knew there was an end goal. I knew there was something. It's probably kind of that kind of work ethic. But if you just keep doing something, something eventually comes out of it. If you do what you're interested in, you just keep plugging away at it, something will happen. So that's what I've taken from that.
So, you talked about when you were in New Orleans, Mississippi, and there was the different agencies working together with different groups of people.
Yeah.
Is that similar or completely different to what it was on the ground in the Philippines?
Yeah, completely different. So just to put it very succinctly, when we arrived in Mississippi, it was NGOs, non-governmental organisations. It was the kind of more charity type. The Red Cross was there delivering food. There was ground organisations just started, community organisations. There was the kind of upper levels from the government that were trying to do their best, and it's been well reported that their best maybe wasn't good enough, and the response time wasn't quick enough.
But there's an organisation that springs to mind, FEMA.
So the FEMA trailers were the transitional homes that the residents were put into. So usually in a scale response, a disaster happens, the first responder is always the residents. We always think it's something higher, bigger, but it's your next door neighbour that responds to you. Then FEMA would come in as an emergency infrastructure. They'd find out needs, deliver water, things like that. As I say, that was well reported on how late that was. But then we've got this kind of commons of volunteers and everything coming in after that. The disaster happens, then there's response, then the kind of government comes in, then there's intergovernmental support through the UN agencies, which I didn't really see on the ground in after Katrina. Then there's transitional homes, which will be the trailers, in some cases the shelters that we were building in the Philippines. And then there's the core homes, or the more permanent homes that are way more resilient, or supposed to be. In the Philippines, I have arrived, and houses were starting to be built using coco lumber. The storm was so strong that something like 50 million coconut trees were reported to have been felled during the storm. The government had thought, you know, can we use this? So I quickly became someone that didn't know about coco lumber to an expert very quickly, that kind of DIY process, asking people. So we had the material, and the actors that were there, WHO had just left, the World Health Organization were making sure the sanitation and everything was there. Intergovernmental organisations, UN Migration, UNHCR had supplied the tents. What I would term as the big UN actors were all in place, and they were now just being supported by some very, very good charities. Tsuchi, the kind of Buddhist organisation, the Red Cross, CARE, a number of really good international charities. But so
you've arrived and you can see the problems, you can see the resources that are there in terms of this cocoa, presumably green cocoa lumber, that, you know, it's not matured and hardened like you would normally use in the West. What was your analysis, and then how did you put that into practice?
So this is probably a bit more interesting to your listeners than my backstory, but that's a really good question. Arriving there, coco lumber is the opposite of a tree. It's like a straw. The water goes up the centre, and the harder elements are on the outside, softer elements on the inside. So, first of all, my analysis was what material we're using and what's the properties of it. I could go to Google. I could search textbooks, but my approach is always ask locals as much as possible. Have you been using this? How do you use it? Getting some carpenters in. So we were lucky enough that the first project I had arrived at, which maybe wasn't going in the best way, it was what I would term as a rational building very, very fast, a kind of system ones approach. We stopped construction on site until we could find out the properties, find out the best materials, find out who was going to build it. Because, again, a lot of the time I think charities have a kind of means to end. They produce plans, say, here's what you're going to build, and then go forward. Whereas having been in Mississippi and seeing this kind of not really working, I thought, do we have training facilities? Can we incorporate that? We had 12 carpenters, and we got together and said, you know, does this work? And they were finding a way to communicate is always interesting. Fortunately, in the Philippines, there's karaoke bars. And so we can go to a karaoke bar and we can kind of talk in a relaxed and in a very informal way. And I can hear about the families and I can hear about technical things. And I think many of your listeners, a carpenter's always got a story on site. So they're always willing to tell you about a scar or something like that. So there was a human element to that. So there was a strategy, but the strategy was to kind of humanise it. These 12 carpenters quickly orientated themselves into, I'm really good at this, I'm really good at that, I can do this. Some stronger than others, some needed a bit of confidence, but those guys were the tools that I had at hand, and I thought that was really interesting. They knew the material better than anyone, so I wasn't going to be turn up and I need you to build this. There was a design provided by an architect who had already been there. It was a Cambodian kind of Malay style hut. As a transitional home, other homes have been built very quickly, and we thought, do you know what, these 12 guys we can basically take this design apart and put it into a kind of Ford style, you know, the wheels, the chassis, in our case it was the foundation, the superstructure, the roofing, the walls, and we can really look at each part and make it more efficient, stronger with the materials that we had. So those 12 guys divided into their teams. They picked 3 or 4 guys to help them out, the unskilled labour. That was a training facility. I didn't know it at the time, but that's how we run it. So instead of saying, I'm the project manager, you guys go over there, you guys go over there, it was quite systematic. And when you look at these transitional shelters, you don't realise there's a system behind it. And as a designer, I like designing the construction process so it's more efficient, get people looking after each other, people learning skills, so building that capacity, knowledge. So to get an unskilled person just through that kind of level of trauma, it was a supportive environment. It didn't have an authoritarian hierarchy. It was quite equal. It always gets better if we put floor standing speakers on our sites, played 80s and 90s music throughout the day. We had a
it's just like a week long montage there.
That's it was if you've ever seen Filipino carpenters on site, they smile all the time. They smile even more if Frank Sinatra's playing in the background. So that was part of it. We had a morning meeting, so everyone knew what they were doing. But just to say that we had a 12-day strategy, and that was the 12 components of the home. So after 12 days, we had built a house, but it meant that systematically, the next day we built the 13th, the next day we built the 14th, 15th, and that was with 60 carpenters altogether. By the time we had gotten to the third and fourth site, we were up to 400 workers completing 36 houses a week. So we built in incentives and said, you know, bring your family, we'll have food days, bring anyone that wants to work, and we'll find a way of getting them getting you a certificate of work to see what your skills are. So by the end we had a matrix, and everyone left with a, you know, they had 64 different skill sets, and for some of the families there, they'd never received anything, and they've never heard anyone say, that's a brilliant job, that's great, you know what you're doing is brilliant. And so these were the guys that were staying in tents, so they're working all day and going back to a tiny camp in the centre.
So these were the displaced persons themselves were part of the workforce.
It was it's a very crude term called cash equity. So you're displaced, you've just been through a level of trauma, and you're back on a site. So making that site, you know, just giving them the keys for the site and leaving and saying, we'll be back in 2 weeks, build that. I couldn't think of anything worse. Mm-hmm. I think as all hands, as a group, we kind of decided that as a team, we should kind of humanise, and I'll say this time and time again, humanise the process of construction post-disaster. You don't know what people have been through, and it's probably one of the best jobs I've been involved in.
So one of the things you do with your students at Duncan & Jorgensen College of Art and Design, which is part of Dundee University, is you think about how the temporary accommodation can be used. You think about the specific needs of people. You think beyond the actual housing. You think about the economy and how people live.
Yeah.
How much of that did you do when you went to the Philippines? Because this is when you were at the beginning.
Yeah.
You had to go through the experience to learn all of this. So how successful were you at matching the needs of the people that you were trying to house?
Again, that's a good question, because on the volunteer group that we worked with worked in the communities. Our bases were in the communities. We slept in the tents. We didn't stay in the hotels. We ate the food provided by local people, and we spent our money in the best way that we could, and made tons of friends out there. That gave me a very good introduction to humanitarian architecture and kind of where you're situated. As we built from there, and I started working for UN Migration, or the International Organization of Migration, that was this is the same unit. That's when I started to be a bit more aware of the governmental side of it. UN Migration is an intergovernmental unit, so we're going in and we're providing support technically, logistically, finding the bigger picture. So I had to learn very, very quickly. If anyone's out there that ever worked for any UN agency, they speak in IOM, BOR, TCU. So the lexicon of that takes a lot of time to get used to, but there is geopolitics based in that. You know, you can't change the we were going to pay, like anyone would, you know, what are you going to pay your carpenter? Oh, I'm going to pay him as much as I possibly can. We can't do that because there's 400 people. You might actually change the economy. I didn't realise that, so I had a lot of learning to do, and then sitting at one of those UN tables, like out of a Bond film, does quite intimidating. So I did my research. I worked very, very hard. I went home at night and I kind of talked to people, got their knowledge and sort of tried to build on my knowledge. What that brought to the university was still questioning, is this the right response? Is the UN's close enough to the people in the villages to find out needs, you know, find out what people are looking for? And bridging that gap's really difficult. So what I wanted to do is to come back to university and start questioning the students, like, what do you think we can do? How do you think we can... and it was going to be difficult to get students out there to disaster zone, one. And to realise that all these things go on, it's a lot to take in. I took, you know, 3 years or 2.5 years kind of in and around the Philippines and Nepal to kind of understand this kind of bottom down, top down approach and where to fit in the middle. So the university's kind of given me, or the unit has given me, a kind of mind map to kind of place where everything fits and what makes sense. And I think that's great for students to understand the kind of the macro understanding of what's happening after a disaster, and also the micro understanding, the human element of it. And I've been blown away by the maturity and the response the students have had to that in Dundee, which has made it a more richer experience for me, but also a richer learning experience for myself.
Is this where then the trip to Turkey kind of seems to follow on from here?
That's exactly quite neatly. Yeah, I think that's exactly... I started planning it in April this year, working again with the volunteer group that we had, that I had worked with.
Remind me, the incident was in February.
That was in February, but they had opened up the volunteer group very quickly. Turkey had opened their borders, unlike Morocco, it took a long time to open up its relief lines. Turkey had opened it up quite quickly. The group had established with universities in Turkey, and it started to click. Maybe here's an opportunity to do this. The All Hands offers a volunteer place, provides food, provides accommodation, as long as you work. And people work when they go there. So I had to get the university on board, and I have to say, you know, gratis to the university. They've been so supportive. And
what about parents of the students? How do you get them to sign that permission slip?
I think our year five students are mature enough to sign what they're going into, but we made sure that we had two meetings with the group before we went out. We recognised that there was not just seismic issues, there was recent 4.5 earthquakes, there was, you know, aftershocks, but there's also political. It had just happened after Erdogan had come into power, so there was political tensions. You can imagine my risk assessment was about 30 pages long for this, but part of this is the maturity and understanding those issues. You don't go into, you don't walk into this as a holiday. There's a kind of matrix of complexities, and you're always balancing risk in this case, to use reward. The reward was empirical study for students to actually experience, having a visceral experience of listening to people, and that's where Turkey came in. It gave us the students, the first day they arrived, there was hailstones the size of walnuts that were beating off the tents. The tents had been through, we lived in the hills in Karahanmarash, which is southeast Turkey, so it's fairly close to the Syrian border, close enough that Syrian refugees were living in the camps in the city. The city had seen half of the building network in the more traditional area completely razed to the ground, and the government was systematically raising them to make it safe. Life was still going on, as I've experienced. You know, it's not people running around with their hands on their head. It's life goes on. But the first day they arrived, hailstorms, and I arrived the next day morning, just a couple of hours after them, and they were sweeping up, picking up. Everyone's, oh, we were up last night, we did this and we got on with it. And they were out on a building site at 7 o'clock in the morning to avoid the heat. And they came back and sweat pouring everywhere, mud all over their face. And
describe the physical situation there, the building materials available,
yep,
the process you have to go through before you start that.
Yeah, so just to give you an idea, Carraghan Marash, a lot of the houses have been razed to the ground in the inner city. So in most cases, the closest transitional sites are 20, 30 minutes, sometimes up to an hour drive outside the city. So that's where that displacement is completely different from Mississippi. So the houses are still in the same site. So we're travelling 30 miles out into the industrial quarters and in the industrial belt. So materials are quite readily available. Turkey has a very good reputation of trade. So there is it's very central to a lot of other countries. So it does have timber, steel, all the components that it's not the Philippines. It's not Northern Nepal or anything like that. It's quite centrally placed to do quite a fast amelioration project. But the students went out, the timber shades that were being proposed for the transitional camps. I'll just give you a picture of the transitional camps. It's about 6,000 containers all laid out in a street-like format, not all level, with intense heat. Some of the heat in the site got up to about 48 to 50 degrees during the day. The Turkish people who owned property received a trailer. The Syrian refugees still stayed in tents. And don't really want to go too much into that. It's just that's just how the government is assessing needs at the moment. But our group and the students were placed with building shelter areas for the families to congregate during the day, kids to come together during the day. There was play parks that were set up very quickly, but they weren't being used. It's 50 degrees, so with no shade. So no one's playing in the play parks. No one's playing in the basketball courts that they've put up. Again, needs. Shade was the biggest thing. So the students got hands-on. You know, they're using good materials, using the timber locally supplied. We had screw guns, mostly getting good quality DeWalt components on site. Chop saws. We were in a big tent as a kind of workshop. It was very safe. But we had meals in the camps, in the marketplace, talking to people. People would come over and bring us tea. We'd make a point of setting aside, you know, and sitting down with them and questioning them, or not questioning, actually listening. It was really important that we set that agenda, that this wasn't a tourist trip. It was a field kind of study of needs, and it wasn't a questionnaire. So that's really important to stress, that it was human. But that's what they were, and the students had never really marked out before. They'd never built anything really, and that's something that I really want to change. But yeah, they were in there full day's work, 7:30 to 3:30, coming back with a bucket shower, cold bucket of water and a scoop. Very little electricity. We had a fire at night because the temperature dips to about 20 degrees. 16 degrees. It was quite cold at night. So the students living in tents and actually finding out what that's like. Admittedly for 10 days, but it's quite a sharp difference to what they're experiencing at the moment. So I mean, for myself, it was, that's how it was when I was 20-odd, living in the tent and going to work, coming back and being physically exhausted, never a good night's sleep. And the students definitely wanted to stay longer. They wanted to experience as much as they could. But there was a chance to get back into the city and actually map it in different ways.
Let's think about some of the international situations that we have now. There's a report coming out from Amnesty International. They've got a video. It shows the difficulties that some of the people in Ukraine are having, disabled people, because they can't access the temporary accommodation that's been provided for them. Or alternatively, the institutions. They're in institutions, the people in wheelchairs are in bed and there's no one to get them out of bed. They can't get into their wheelchair, so they're in danger of atrophy. How can you adapt temporary accommodation, emergency type things, to the individual needs of people?
It's a big question. Can I just say, or just a caveat to the Turkey trip, our unit for the students, who there's no requirement to do international travel for many reasons. So the unit's set up, so we did look at the Ukrainian volunteer, Ukrainian displacement, to Scotland and looked at one of the most successful areas where community came together, and that's Aberfeldy, where it's very a very rooted community based in volunteer and collectivism, got together, formed a ring of trust, as they termed it, and took in a huge number of Ukrainian volunteers. That process of that is coming to an end soon, and there's big questions about what happens going forward for able-bodied, but also for very specific needs going forward. So that's a big question that we're looking at. So a couple of students in the unit are looking at that in a Scottish context. To go back to how would you adapt for that going forward, my answer would be it's based on context. So in the Philippines, we looked at a kind of vulnerability index. So there will be people that will knock on doors and look for inquiry and inquire about very, very specific needs. And people will be placed in camps. So say they're close to main access routes for ambulance and things like that. But I think maybe what you're asking is the ergonomics of these of design.
And the houses that you built were built in stilts.
Yeah, yeah.
So that obviously creates a challenge.
It does. So again, very specifically, we're working with topography. So there's some cases where we could have lowered the building and still had some space underneath. You know, by excavation, we can. Lucky when you get the UN funding, you can spend a bit of money to actually very specifically respond to needs. So there is cases where we had to do that. Again, another interesting fact is when you start building homes like this, you realise there's very rooted culture in there. So the number of steps was really important in the Philippines. To arrive on your living floor on an odd number, I believe, someone might correct me out there, was quite bad luck. So we had so all of these little things. It's not in a manual. It's not in the Barefoot Architect. It's not in Nicholas Pevsner. It's it's probably not in any of these manuals. It's very rooted to Leyte Island. So dealing with that and adapting to that and understanding that is quite a challenge. But there is ways of doing it. Maybe not just for people in restricted to a wheelchair, but also very young children who want to run about. The adaptability of the material that we were using, the carpenters, because of that capacity of building, they were building, security steps. They were building. They were adapting to how they wanted to live their way. And I think that's credit to the initial design. It was set up as a really strong superstructure. That there were sacrificial elements, which meant they could be mended in affordably, but very quickly. But it meant that you could adapt to specific needs, and that really happened. I used to have a rule: if there was any timber left on site that was smaller than your elbow, that was common. Anyone could use it to adapt their building, and that's actually come into a part of my research. Look at the behaviour of how people have adapted their shelter, so that we don't have to constantly ask and questionnaire. We can actually see the behaviour and adapt it. So that's quite a big body of research that I didn't realise was going to come out of this. But yeah, I'm not sure if I answered your question, but it's very rooted in specific topography.
This specific Amnesty International report has seen some things as simple as a ramp to this temporary accommodation.
Yeah,
not only just helps the older people gain access, but it keeps them with their family and it stops them from being isolated. I think it changes. It's a press release that I saw that I may, before our initial conversation, not have given too much thought about.
Yeah.
But it's highlighted to me the importance of these authorities and humanitarian agencies just becoming a bit more inclusive in their approach.
Yeah. No, I definitely, in my experience, in Mississippi, there was a case where people had been badly hurt during the storm. The FEMA trailers had no adaptability at all, really, and their houses then needed to be adapted. But I completely agree that it's talking with the community and not making general assumptions of one rule for everyone. And there's an interesting way in how we design our buildings, but also how we design our construction methodology and our processes to actually be adaptive to that. I don't think it's here's one unit for restricted access. Here's one unit for a family, three. I think it has to be part of a process, and that adaptability has to come into it. Yeah, I think a one-size-fits-all model is what's assumed in disaster. You know, there's used to be a kind of, how do we get buildings into shipping containers, ship them halfway around the world, and then pop them up? And I'd say that doesn't work. In my experience, that's not been favourable to governments or people and communities.
Well, they're going to have the wrong number of steps, aren't they?
One, they're going to have the wrong number of steps. Two, it's, you know, where's this crane that's going to arrive when you can't get a crane? Where's the people to be that kind of louder voice to actually strategize this? Who does that? But when it's done within a community and it's questions have been asked, things have been agreed, the builders are the residents. It's not always the case, you can't always do that, but it was a good scenario in the Philippines. It was a good scenario in New Orleans. But this is the bigger question, and Amnesty International are coming out with fantastic reports highlighting gender-based violence, water security, food security in certain areas. Now, I'm not sure about your listeners or yourselves, but when I was training as an architect, that wasn't an issue. If it's not there your everyday, you just don't consider it. So you go straight into your everyday, hey, where do the toilets go? Where's the shower? You know, that's not always the case. So for a designer coming in and going, right, how do people live? Do they have showers? You know, that assumption goes right out the window and it becomes way more interesting. But again, it becomes a bit more people-based design. We sadly lost John Turner, an architect who he spent a lot of time in South America, and he came back and he said, you know, architects could learn a lot from slum developments. He wasn't being crass in that way. He was talking about your roads don't need to be exactly 6 metres. You can have small, intimate spaces. Your water supply needs to be fresh. And queues don't come after it. They're integrated into different systems, and I think we're looking at post disaster in a completely different way now. But I still hear these words of, you know, what are people saying?
One of your students came up with the concept of a serviced island, so that if I've understood it correctly, you prepare a site, you put in all the services, and then people locally can build what they need.
That's right. It's loosely based on the architects Elemental, Alejandro Aravena, proposed at Half House in Chile. And it was, you can build a whole house for a certain amount, but you can build a good, strong half house, of which could be developed after a certain period of time, or if you get a job, or if your family grows, or your needs are change. There's critics out there. I'm critical of some parts of it, but I still think it's a really good system of how we approach these big questions that we've got.
Can we apply any of this experience to the local situation? We've got a housing emergency in Edinburgh, officially. We don't have a housing emergency in Scotland because government doesn't think it's a housing emergency, but they do think it's pretty serious. I think in Glasgow they're declaring a housing emergency. We know about rural homelessness, and we know there are real pressures on local businesses because staff can't find anywhere to live. But unlike some of the places that you've worked, we have building codes, we have planning, we have all sorts of bureaucracy that gets in the way of actually just erecting a tent, building a shack, getting a caravan, or actually building a property. It's a lot harder here because of the high standards in the way that we've set ourselves. What can we do to somehow or other free up the supply of housing to enable us to cope with these housing emergencies? Or am I just going up completely up the wrong hill?
I think there is a... we need to do to get together to ask what transitional housing is, and is it an acceptable typology in Scotland or in the UK as a whole. I think there is a big question there and what people's expectations of that might be. I know the buildings in Granton for as kind of temporary housing incorporated kind of some kind of level of food security. There was craft, there was a level of engagement, but it was built right over from a college where people were learning plumbing and things like that. So there's maybe ways that we could integrate that capacity building level? Can we maybe integrate a system where people are learning that pragmatic learning actually has a benefit to the end user? So there's maybe like a, I keep saying system, I don't believe it's
instead
systems.
Of, instead of what's happening now, is it courses for building techniques across colleges, across Scotland are closing?
Yeah. Well, that's, yeah, but if they were integrated maybe into a build,
there'd be a clearer path.
Be a clearer path, yeah. But I'd want to be on it.
Yeah.
I mean, I know a number of architects that might come out of their 3 years and go, actually, I want to learn how to build, and I want to learn how to maybe learn a design strategy. So I think, as I said, I think the sector's changing. I'm just 43. I'm still like a bairn trying to figure all this out. But I have seen it being successful in areas that have reduced their building code level a little bit. Whether the building code's reduced or not, we still have a skill shortage, and that skill shortage might meet another shortage, and maybe a symbiotic relationship that there's a byproduct of really good housing, or I think that'd be a great way to create that great apprenticeship scheme again, which I kind of wanted to do when I was leaving school. I wanted to be the joiner, but 1997, the recession came and a lot of apprenticeships were lost. So maybe that apprentice stability could be maintained by, well, we can't do that because we're building a number of homes. As I say, I don't have the ideas, but can I ask the question in the university.
Can I ask the same question in a different way? So rather than what can we learn about building homes, it's more what can we learn about the relationships that it takes to build.
Yeah.
The relationships between different trades,
yeah,
different people, basically.
That's right.
So, like, yeah. Go back to your architect friend,
yeah.
Who said, "What can we learn?
Yeah,
from slum practices.
Mm.
What can we learn from your experiences? What can the students learn? How can their approach to design change?"
Well, it's actually it's quite opposite to what's happening this week. We actually have a module, and I run year one in the MArch, and we have engineers coming into the architecture department. They're working on models. They're, you know, talking to each other in the same language before the, you know, before the ego comes out. That's terrible. Before the professional language starts to really appear, and then we go into a very strict disciplines, you know. I think that kind of has to open up a little bit. I always found it quite difficult going onto a site as a designer and talking to all the trades, and I think that has just been accepted, honestly, again, in my experience. I think if there was some kind of open learning experience where trades did overlap with designers, then we reduce the fake hierarchy that exists and actually put everyone on quite a diplomatic design team. I think that would be really beneficial going forward and quite refreshing. I know it sounds quite like everyone's on the same level and everyone like hugs at the end of the day. We all do, you know.
It's a minor appreciation of everybody's role, isn't it?
That's exactly it. It's accepting of roles and to go back to the question, what can we accept? I never designed the homes. I only strategized the system to make it more efficient. That's all I was trying to do. But it meant that the carpenters talked with the very experienced engineers that were being brought in. I introduced them, they talked, and they had a laugh. And we were all looking at this, going to the same goal of how do we build this in the best way, in the most efficient way. And I've seen carpenters in the Philippines take down work. You know, we're in a housing emergency here, but they were taking down work because they were saying this isn't strong enough, and that was accepted by everyone.
Well, let's take a homegrown example. The V&A is an incredible building, beautiful architecture, but it took an incredibly clever designer to work out. Sorry, an incredibly clever engineer to work out to actually build it.
Yeah,
because you shouldn't really be able to build that; it'll fall over.
Yeah.
So, you know, there has to be that cooperation between the trades. But anyway, what's next for you? What happens next?
What's the next adventure? As someone who hardly made it through high school, or got told that they wouldn't they wouldn't get through high school. I have to pinch myself that my job doesn't feel like a job. I love the learning from the students. I love being in a studio environment. I love trying to answer big questions. I love it when people ask the big questions, and I'm never someone that says, I know exactly how that is. We have to think about it. So I would like to continue doing this as long as the university let me work there. But on a serious note, I think the reflecting on what the experience was with the students and hearing their feedback, I would like to do this more. I'd like to take students volunteering, but also if there was ever a case where we could establish a unit in Dundee where we did talk to the UN agencies and did establish something a bit more, a bit stronger, and say, you know, students are actually coming up with really good projects, and I think some of them actually could be realised. That's maybe the next big part of where I go. In any way that I can get students to get tools in their hands and actually, as we were talking about, engage with practitioners, talk the same language, make something and enjoy making. There's a rural studio in Alabama where Sam Mockney took students in, and there's no building code in this certain area in Alabama, and it's now run by Andrew Freeman. They designed and they built for the most vulnerable people. I'd love to have gone there. There wasn't enough warehouses at the time that I could have worked in and paid to do it, but I think giving students options of what practice is now instead of here's one route. But I do want, if there's anyone listening that might want to take students on to visit sites or just be a little bit more proactive in workshops, bench joinery, just getting used to that, I think it's
We'll put your contact details in the show notes if you just want to get in touch with Lawrence. But
that'd be great.
Fascinating talk, and thanks for coming on to the podcast. Jimmy and I will be back next year.